This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 5th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 442. Happy Easter and happy Passover. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, by word of virtual Nanaimo Bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, the MMA panel returns to look back at the first quarter of 2026 with Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Okay, this is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast, the MMA panel. I'm Mackin, that is Mario Canseco of Research Co., and that is the A, Andy Yan, Simon Fraser University City Program Director.
We're not AI.
So MMA, the MMA panel, that is your update on who we are and what we're doing here at the Main on Main Street in Vancouver. We're here to look at the first quarter of 2026. Yeah, we're one quarter of the way through 2026. And we're going to start looking at civic politics first, because this is a municipal election year across British Columbia. The big race here in the city of Vancouver is the incumbent Mayor Ken Sim and his ABC majority. They're trying to stay in power. And it didn't go very well for Mayor Ken Sim and one of his councillors, Lenny Zhou, when they held a Chinese media roundtable, and they also talked a bit about that on WeChat, making some false allegations against COPE councillor Sean Orr. Sean Orr has responded by filing a defamation lawsuit against Ken Sim. Andy Yan, what was your first reaction when you heard these false allegations by Ken Sim claiming that Sean Orr was selling drugs in Christmas time?
I mean, how it first came up was actually through Lenny Zhou, and how Lenny had made a posting on WeChat in Mandarin about how it was, and it extended not only to Sean Orr but to all non ABC members of council, how they were giving away drugs in Christmas, and within that, equivocating the support of housing as drug houses. And that's a direct quote from the translation that, as seen on the Breaker.News, and really coming into, I think, really the unfortunate element of trying to use in language on a platform that's not English, and trying to encrypt this, I mean, quite seemingly defaming kind of statements. And it was surprising, but it was also very disappointing. And really the reaction, or how it could be relatively simply resolved, but not pursuing that resolution, was really surprising to see that type of behavior for a sitting mayor and city council member. Because then, of course, then it later on kind of became apparent that this was all done in this Chinese language roundtable for Chinese media, that it was actually the mayor who made the comments. And I think that really illustrates really some ongoing challenges in terms of really what the mayor faces in his re-election.
Mario Canseco, you had reactions, two different reactions from two different politicians. You had Sean Orr, he has said it has harmed his reputation and caused him a lot of anxiety, as it would if these kind of allegations were made against anyone. He has taken stances before, of course, on safe supply, promoting basically the agenda of the NDP. But this didn't happen as Ken Sim said it did, and Sean Orr, his response was that he was actually on the Sunshine Coast and he may have given a couple of brewskis to his father-in-law. But then you had the response of Ken Sim, kind of a deer in the headlights response at a news conference, where he kept repeating the same line that he'd apologized to Sean Orr. Of course, that apology wasn't good enough, so that's why Sean Orr took that next step into the courts.
Lack of preparedness from the entire office. I think that is part of it. You can't just walk away from something like this and say, I apologized and that is it. the fact that this could have been a 24-hour, 48-hour story, and it's still something that we're talking about later because of the way in which the city staff tried to deal with it. You know, you can't call a press conference where you say the mayor is going to be available and then have him answer the same question four times and then exit the room. It's not conducive to building trust with voters in an election year. And it's also problematic because of what it does to the system of politics. When you have this type of allegations just making their way, and it's another example of how you can't go by social media as the barometer of everything, because you're bombarded with things that are terrible on both sides, people who are supporting each other and saying, well, it's really not that bad for the mayor to have said something like this, because at some point, some other Cope councillor actually gave drugs to people. It's just not the kind of thing that boosts voter turnout in a moment when the best thing that could happen for the incumbent party is to have fewer voters casting ballots.
I mean, the initial action was terrible, but the reaction was worse.
Yeah.
I think it was 16 apologies in 5 minutes. That was a repeat mixed in with a news conference that was 5 minutes, and then and then no questions and disappearing. So it's one of those scenarios where the initial act was not great. I mean, if you think about like this, really a candidate trying to encrypt really a message to a non-English speaking population and trying to get away with that is mixed in with a terrible response once caught. And I think that this is really like where a simple apology on platform could have just really ended it within 24 hours. We're still talking about this. And I mean, to me, I mean, I have to admit, being a member of the Chinese Canadian community, I am a bit upset that, you know, trying to encrypt a message in language, I think, is really not healthy for a multilingual, multicultural democracy.
Now, here we are after the first quarter of 2026. This is the first full quarter under the new ABC majority budget, the zero means zero budget, the tax freeze that Ken Sim and his ABC majority voted on and passed at the end of 2025. It's also a time when the city is now struggling, like many are, with the higher cost of living due to the higher cost of fuel and other aspects of inflation after the start of Donald Trump's war with Israel against Iran. That's working its way through the economy throughout the world, as well as everyone's kitchen table. You also have the situation where City of Vancouver has a smaller budget and smaller workforce. There have been some layoffs as they're planning for the FIFA World Cup, which starts in June and July, the 7 matches at BC Place. You also do have other earlier events. It's going to impact City of Vancouver much sooner than just June 13th when the first match is. How is City Hall managing, in your opinion, with this economic reality of having less revenue because of the tax freeze, at a time when inflation is still a major problem and one of the world's biggest sporting events is just around the corner?
It's ultimately about what you can show for it afterwards. And, you know, it really takes me back to the early stages of the 2010 Olympics, when people were really upset with Vanok, and you're not allowing me to drive, and there's places where I can't go, and why are all these cops here at my Starbucks? And then, you know, you win the medals, people get happier, and then you start to lose sight of what it meant for the city. Oh, it was great, and it generated revenue, and everybody's happy. Now, this is something that can happen in an event where you have several possibilities of winning Olympic medals, including gold, which is what we saw in 2010.
Golden hockey.
That is probably not going to happen with the Canadian national team. And it raises the onus of what is it going to mean for the city when everything happens? And what happens if something goes bad? If there's a fight in the stands, if there's somebody who gets in there with a weapon, it's the kind of thing that is going to be discussed at length, as it should be, even with all of the intricacies that an event like this has. But, you know, part of the rationale for this is what happens after the World Cup. Is that a moment where Ken Sim goes, we've achieved everything that we could have, and now I'm going to step aside and somebody else will be the candidate? Or is this the moment where you go, this is why we need to bring more world-class events, and this is why I am the person who should be doing this for you? But it's not something that is eternal. You know, we saw in 2010 Gordon Campbell waving the British Columbia flag, being introduced erratically by NBC as the governor of British Columbia. And a few months later, people were upset with the HST. So there's an expiry date to the level of hope and joy that an event like this can provide if it goes perfectly.
No, that's a really interesting point, and I think that it's really, you know, arguably how so much is hinged upon how well the World Cup will do in Vancouver. But I think it's a fact of matter is zero means zero, kind of. That if you actually look at really some of the spending motions, some of the increases in fees, that it may mean zero property tax increases, but it doesn't mean it's free. It means that we've seen increases in terms of fees. We see, I think, issues around our drinks have come.
Thank you.
So this is how it's not AI. that really covers, I think how even saying a statement like zero means zero has not meant zero spending in terms of the new police academy that is, and it's even just a $2 million. I think we may be talking about that later on, but that it's a $2 million initial spend. We haven't seen necessarily, and I think, mind you, there have been other, I think, policies around helping out with festivals that really mix into this kind of state of the city. Is we're losing a lot of our key festivals, our prominent festivals have actually faced huge pressures in terms of cost and how the city is trying to make an intervention, but then ultimately how hard it is to come out with a statement of zero means zero when there's a complexity and the kind of issues that kind of come up which require a level of flexibility as opposed to taking a stand.
What do you think of this crop so far? Pick one winner and one loser so far.
It's interesting. I mean, it's interesting that, of course, mixed in with one city and William Lazaroff's attempt to become mayor, that they were able to have Francis Beulah, the municipal reporter, that kind of come in as a candidate. But yet, at the same time, it's felt like, you know, in the last couple of weeks, was she running for mayor? That she had a certain profile, and certainly having a very large profile in the history of municipal reporting, I think provides a certain a buzz. But then at the same time, it's not even an official kind of candidacy. It's not even a formal candidacy. It's on the process of becoming a candidate that, you know, that they still have to go through a voting process with one city. That I think that certainly there's kind of been the social media talk, but then the kind of substantial element is really, is anybody paying attention? And I mean, if you just base it on social media, I think, you know, it's interesting to kind of see really how much the Vancouver Liberals actually, I think, have kind of been able to kind of have a presence with bringing in Maura Stillwell and kind of initial, like, teasing whether it's a good business plan or not, bringing in UBC into the city of Vancouver, but yet being able to kind of at least capture a bit of attention and maybe some imagination in terms of just kind of seeing how the election will be shaped. But yet, I think it's still a long way between now and October to kind of see what the major issues are and the kind of personalities that will really form who's running for mayor and council.
I'd have to agree on what was said. There's been a tendency from the Liberals to try to talk about specific things they want to do. It's a different type of engagement with voters. More policy-oriented, more candidate announcements. We haven't said anything about Pete Fry, and he seemed to be the galvanizer of the center-left at some particular moment. You had Cope people present in his candidate announcement, which is, by the way, the last candidate activity that he's had. So there's a lot of confusion in that sense, because there's a lot of people who maybe like Pete Fry, but do you like Pete Fry as a councillor when he's your number 7 vote if you're a center-left voter, or your number 8 vote if you're a center-right voter? Can you have the capacity to be the number 1 person on a mayoral ballot? I think that is part of the challenge. The other thing is, will Cope run a candidate? We don't know yet. A team hasn't announced who their candidate would be. The assumption is it'll be Colleen Hardwick, but we don't know yet. So all of these forces could lead to a situation where the share of the total vote, regardless of the turnout, can come down as low as 35% for Ken Sim, and he still becomes mayor.
And we're looking at provincial politics. The spring session of the legislature is on, and David Eby and the NDP provided a budget in February that really landed with a thud. What do you think right now of the NDP government's fortunes versus the Conservative Party's fortunes, as we're in this unique position of a government which has a lot of problems, and you've got an opposition which is trying to sort itself out? Where do you think the province is going under the NDP government, and can this Conservative crop of leadership contestants help turn this party around?
The one thing that the Conservatives should focus on is the over 55 voter. This is a voter that was a busy Liberal supporter for a long time. Then the pandemic happens. They're very satisfied with John Horgan. They vote en masse for the NDP. They stay with the NDP in 2024. And it's a group that is not going to be swayed by discussions about ostriches or whether the reconciliation industry is a grift or whether we should change the guidelines for sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. This is a voter that worries about the economy, that is more likely to say that the deficit is a problem. And the fact that we're having so many discussions, particularly from staffers from campaigns, fighting each other on Twitter and calling themselves names, I thought John Rostad wanted to avoid a civil war. They already have one in their hands. And unifying a party that is fighting so much at this early stage in the race is going to be very complicated for whoever comes out and becomes the leader. But there's also the complexity of appealing to the base. And you do that with ideology more than, you know, stable management and experience. But can you turn that into something that is going to bring some of the NDP voters who looked at John Rostad and said, I just can't find myself voting for a party headed by this person, to look at the party differently? So you're really running two campaigns, but it's been particularly nasty, especially in the last couple of days, allegations of the list not being shared, who's going to which debate, who's endorsing who. This isn't the kind of situation that leads to a party that emerges united. And I hate to use the word, but that's the word we need to use, even though the BC Liberals took it, to actually fight the NDP in the next election.
Right. And I think it really is interesting to kind of say, what, how are they going to create a united platform? I think that when you look at the successes of the NDP this time around, it was actually how their base had no floor and no ceiling. That is, they had representation from deep urban ridings, but then also some rural ridings. And I think that that was really a strength of the NDP vote versus the Conservative vote, which had a distinct ceiling, meaning that they couldn't break into the urban areas in metropolitan in Vancouver, or, you know, had some movement in terms of suburban votes. But I think that that really kind of illustrates the kind of challenges of governing and how a leader is able to kind of create a message that brings all types of communities together. And I think that this is really going to be a challenge for the Conservatives in terms of reaching out to the kind of urban suburban voters, as opposed to really the other population that kind of has historically voted Conservative. I think that this is really going to be, I think, some really interesting times because of not only what's happening provincially, but then also whatever's outside the control, federally, nationally, and internationally, and really what those kinds of responses are, because, you know, it's still an incredibly dynamic type of environment through which I think on both sides they're going to have some kind of assurance for British Columbians and what they're going to do. But I think so far it's actually anybody's race, I think, in terms of really satisfaction. I think there's a great dissatisfaction around provincial leadership around all parties.
Yeah, there's been major questions about the NDP not delivering on the promises that were made in the 2024 election, not delivering on the promises that were made even before David Eby under John Horgan. We're looking at, I mean, one budgetary decision they had was to delay infrastructure for long-term care for seniors. And if you remember back during the pandemic, when the coronavirus was savaging senior citizens' homes, that was a major concern of John Horgan at the time, and saying we got to do better and build better for the seniors, for the aging population, and that's just one aspect of social spending, of healthcare spending that they just can't do anymore because the deficit is so big, and the money being added to the debt, this government is now losing credit rating points through the major credit rating agencies, and if there is an election this year, the NDP really can't fight
very hard except to point over to the conservatives and say, okay, what are you guys going to cut? That's all they really have.
And I think that really highlights one point in the budget that really surprised me was the cut in non-market housing. That it was in the long-term care homes, it was in this kind of package of housing that you think would be one of the kind of sacred areas that wouldn't see cuts or would see a small, much smaller cut, but then it did get cut. I think it was $1 billion that really, I think, provided a, just a deep surprise and kind of, I think, disappointed a lot of like historic, long-time supporters for the NDP. And I think other types of policies and budget choices was kind of like, okay, well, that kind of fits. But then this particular budget is interesting because it's one of those that kind of ticked off everybody.
Yeah.
It wasn't one that where one party was, okay, kind of satisfied or at least understanding. All sides seem to be disappointed by this budget.
The federal government, the first quarter 2026, Mark Carney was on a world tour.
Yep.
China.
The speech in Davos.
China, India, Australia, Japan, and Davos, the speech at the World Economic Forum, the speech where he got so many plaudits from around the world, pundits everywhere were just falling over themselves with praise, but I listened to that speech closely, and he mentioned Václav Havel, the brave Czech...
the first president of the Czech Republic,
yeah, one of the people that stood up to the Soviet Union, the Iron Curtain, and helped bring it down and helped bring freedom and democracy to Eastern Europe. Mark Carney cited him in that speech after going to China, the biggest dictatorship in the world right now, and declaring a strategic partnership with the same government that is propping up Russia, which is continuing its war on Ukraine. So you have Mark Carney and his world tour not doing a deal with Trump, which he promised during the election last year.
To put it in CFL terms, they're running out the clock. November, all signs indicate that there won't be a majority in the House for the Republicans. The Senate majority is also at play, depending on how the situation goes in a handful of seats, particularly North Carolina. Not enough to impeach him, because you need a significantly larger majority, but certainly enough to try to curb the powers of the Trump presidency, which is in a way the de facto reason for everything not working. I think that helped the David Eby government as well in the first 6 or 7 months. Well, we got to deal with Trump, so you have to wait a little bit longer for things. The problem for Carney isn't whether the NDP is going to, come back with Abby Lewis and get some of those urban voters. It's more whether the conservatives are ready for something that is more conservative than the red Tory government that they have right now. And one way to not do that is to send Pierre Poilievre to do podcasts in the United States.
Right.
Because your women voters, which is what you need to get back, and your over 55 voters, which is also what you need to get back, do not even know who Joe Rogan is. So that is part of the problem here. You need to try to emphasize on your economic management and the types of things that you want to do, instead of trying to run the same campaign that has happened before, where you're appealing to young people, where you're appearing there with some bodybuilding, and you're talking about what you have for breakfast, and that isn't going to convert the voter over 55 who doesn't really care that much about podcasts. They care about policy, and they're not seeing a lot of policy come from a person who was supposed to make things better. In a way, the conservatives are still fighting over a person who left a long time ago, and that person is Justin Trudeau.
There is a bit of a reaction within the NDP to the way it's gone, and its new leader at the end of the first quarter, Avi Lewis, the filmmaker, academic, eco-socialist. He makes no bones about it, about where he is on the political spectrum, and that he wants to bring the NDP further to the left, taking them away from the center. What does this mean?
Well, that's going to be the really serious question here, is really what is the NDP in 2026? How far does it stray away from its roots from labor and into these kinds of social moral issues through which kind of appeal to a particular type of voter, but is it enough of a voter to get you into opposition or get you into office. Like, it's not even like into opposition or government. It's can you get you into office across a very diverse country? I mean, this is really, it's really interesting to kind of see how the NDP will try to reposition. I think there's certainly some of the kind of initial gains in the U.S. I keep on talking about Zahra Mandani kind of having his success, and really how much of, is that an indication or is that a flash in the pan of a type of socialism? But then really the kind of ongoing challenges when it goes to the cost of living, when it goes to the affordable housing question, much less the kind of just overall economics of where Canada is, I think is this really moment that I think is it's more anxious over anything else. And I think that people are still looking for some kind of leadership.
City of Vancouver, born April 6, 1886, 140th birthday. So happy birthday to Vancouver and Vancouverites. And because of that, I've got a special, specially curated, multiple choice trivia section. Ken Sim is the 41st mayor of Vancouver.
Yes.
Who was the first mayor in 1886? And the choices are A, Malcolm McLean, B, David Oppenheimer, C, William Templeton, and D, James Garden.
Malcolm McLean.
Excellent. Malcolm McLean. Now, he was born in Scotland. He was in the real estate business.
Yep. Which, surprise.
Oh, wow. Really? That early?
And he beat Richard Alexander, and the voting tally was 242 to 225. However, there was a voting scandal. There were about maybe 100 ballots that were illegally cast.
Mixed in with, they wanted to exclude the votes that were casted by Chinese workers. So Richard Alexander was also the manager of the Hastings Mill and brought in his Chinese workers to help him win the mayoralty. But Malcolm McLean got those votes excluded.
Which TV station launched in Vancouver on September 5th, 1976? A, BCTV, B, CKVU, C, KVOS, or D, Czech?
CKVU.
They had the Vancouver show. That was their anchor show every night.
Wayne Cox.
Wayne Cox. It's now known as City TV. Famous for Sports Page. Sports Page, the pioneering nightly sports highlights show.
Precursor to ESPN.
Indeed. And also, who remembers when CKVU rebranded itself as UTV? And Jerry Seinfeld did those promos that, UTV, what's the deal with UTV? Okay, and the next question. What was the name of Canada's Vancouver-raised silver medalist at the Montreal Olympics in 1976? So, A, Sue Holloway, B, John Wood, C, Greg Joy, or D, Howard Kelsey?
I surrender.
I'm going to go with Holloway.
C, Greg Joy. Greg Joy in his high jump, the jump for joy.
Yes.
He was Canada's best medalist at 1976. Of course, no Canadian won gold at Montreal in 1976. Now, Greg Joy was born in Portland, but he grew up in Vancouver.
Well, and no gold medals in 88 in Calgary either. Mm-hmm. We had to wait until 2010.
Until 2010.
To hear the anthem and to have a gold medal bestowed upon a Canadian athlete.
Yeah, and of course, that was Alex Bilodeau in freestyle skiing at Cyprus, who won Canada's first gold medal in Canada. At the Canada Pavilion at Expo 86, what grabbed the attention of Prince Charles on opening day, May 2nd, 1986, in Canada Place? What grabbed his attention? Was it A, the beaver mascot, B, a woman other than Princess Diana, C, the High Star airship, or D, the North Shore Mountains?
Huh. Well, we know what could have grabbed the attention of Prince Andrew, but that's another issue. I mean, it was a magical time to kind of watch the High Star, that kind of, like, blown...
Is that your answer?
Yeah, that's my answer, the High Star.
It's the right answer. The High Star airship, that was the unmanned blimp that was used in forestry. Today, you would call the High Star airship a drone.
Yes.
It was really the... we didn't know it at the time, but that was really the biggest technological legacy of Expo 86 that we saw an indoor drone at the Canada Pavilion. Oh. You might know this better than Andy.
Yeah.
Famous Vancouver riots. We've had a lot of riots.
I thought this was going to be quick.
So which of these riots
happened on a Friday night. A, the Stanley Cup Riot 1994. B, the Stanley Cup Riot 2011. C, the Rolling Stones Riot in 1972 outside the Coliseum. Or D, the Grey Cup Riot of 1966. Which one happened on a Friday night?
By process of elimination, the Stones.
All of them?
No, 2012 wasn't on a Friday. I'm pretty sure of that.
I don't know. It's like what we call a riot. I mean, I've heard Lakers fans say that's an average night. So, you know. I mean, it's...
In Philadelphia, exactly.
In Philadelphia, it's an Thursday. Average night in Los Angeles, right? After the Lakers play. But, you know, it's...
Yeah. Well, I'll have to go, eh. D, it was the Grey Cup Riot, 1966, November 25th, 1966, was a Friday night.
Yeah.
They decided to hold the Grey Cup Parade at nighttime. And of course, the Grey Cup is known as the national drinking party of Canada, basically. Yeah. So too many people got too happy with the potent potables in downtown Vancouver and started fights. That was the last time we had a Friday night Grey Cup Parade in Vancouver.
And that explains it.
And we'll end off on another beer themed question. The brewery on Burrard Street, one of Vancouver's most famous industrial buildings, it was the home of Molson until it moved to Chilliwack in 2016. It was opened in 1953. It's empty right now, used for some film shoots, and it could be redeveloped.
For rezoning for a large residential development.
Mm-hmm. It's close to Sanac, the Squamish Nation residential towers opening this year. But it opened in 1953, and it had a very interesting neon structure above. And so what number was on top of the big neon Capilano weather beacon? Was it A, 1886? Was it B, 1953? Was it C, 1786? Or was it D, 6?
I got this. E, 6, 7. I have to extend your listenership here, so I'll say E67. It's all you, man. It's all
53.
You. Oh. Andy, you're so close. The actual
answer—the
actual answer was six. D six.
Well, he gets half a point then.
Well, I guess we get half a point.
Why is it six?
Well, six because the owner of the brewery was Emil Sick from Seattle, and Emil Sick owned six Western Canadian breweries. Emil Sick is also famous locally as the builder of Nat Bailey Stadium. Huh. Back then, it was known as Capilano Stadium in 1951. The 75th anniversary season for the stadium is this year. The Vancouver Canadians of the Northwest League are playing there. But Emil Sick, kind of a play on his name, and he owned six Western Canada breweries. And so the number six was on top of the neon weather beacon on top of the Capilano Brewery, as it was known back in 1953, on Burrard Street, eventually became the Molson Brewery. Vancouver celebrates its 140th birthday on April 6th. And that's also the end of this edition of the MMA panel on the Breaker.News podcast. First M is Mario, the president of Research Co. here in Vancouver. I'm the other M, Mackin, Bob Mackin, the Breaker.News. And the A is the one and only Andy Yan, the Duke of Data.
Always a pleasure.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Taiwan EV firms expand into Southeast Asia with battery swapping push. Founded in 2011, Gogoro has built more than 2,700 battery swapping stations across Taiwan, serves over 650,000 riders, and handles around 370,000 battery swaps a day. Gogoro plans to launch a pilot program in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. Taiwanese joint venture Ionex has also launched two new electric scooter models in Bangkok. In ABC News Australia, fuel ships on the way as hundreds of petrol stations run dry over long weekend. Energy Minister Chris Bowen has revealed 410 stations across Australia have run out of diesel, while another 145 stations are out of unleaded petrol.
53 fuel shipments are en route to Australia. In Kyoto news, Japan is planning to send business delegation to Russia as early as May. The Japanese government has asked at least five major trading houses and shipping companies like Mitsui OSK Lines to join. With concerns growing over energy imports from the Middle East due to the Iran war, the procurement of Russian crude oil could be discussed. Russia's invasion of Ukraine continues and economic sanctions by Japan and the rest of the West remain in place.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, new health program paid millions to ineligible patients audit finds. Auditors with the Oregon Secretary of State's office found the Oregon Health Authority broke federal rules after it launched a program in 2024 as part of the Oregon Health Plan to cover people who earn too much for Medicaid but still struggle to pay for health insurance. Problems led to at least $8 million in confirmed improper payments tied to eligibility errors, along with roughly $7 million in likely improper payments based on case reviews, according to the audit. In Cascadia Daily News, rising gas prices add to Bellingham residents' burdens. Experts say spike may not be enough to push people away from gas cars, at least for now. In Washington, the average cost per gallon was $5.36 on April 1st, up from $4.37 per gallon a month ago, according to the American Automobile Association. It's not quite the record high of $5.55 per gallon that drivers saw in 2022 after Russia invaded Ukraine, but it is causing pain at the pumps. Washington does not get its oil from the Middle East, but instead from nearby producers like Alaska, North Dakota, and Alberta. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. BC legislature lawn transformed into showcase for FIFA and some of its World Cup sponsors. And revealed agenda for Ottawa meeting of bureaucrats, diplomats, and FIFA execs.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to BC Transplant, which promotes organ donation. April 7th is Green Shirt Day for organ donation awareness in memory of Logan Boulay, one of the Humboldt Broncos whose organs gave life to others. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for April 5th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 5th of April in 1958, Ripple Rock in British Columbia's Seymour Narrows was destroyed by one of the biggest non-nuclear explosions in history? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. Go to bobmackin.substack.com for more information. Thank you. And you might be wondering why I'm here outdoors for this edition. I'm at New Brighton Park in East Vancouver. New Brighton Park in 1863, this is where Vancouver began. Vancouver, of course, on April 6th, 2026, turns 140 years old. So happy birthday, Vancouver, and sunnier days ahead for Vancouver, sunnier days ahead for New Brighton Park.
Until next week.